This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. In this crepuscular space, we're joined by the world's leading experts who, in the next half hour, can tell us everything we might want to know about a burning issue of the day. Today, we're looking at the impact of Donald Trump's sudden decision to withdraw US troops from northern Syria and how that decision has changed the region. And if you enjoy this podcast, you might like some of our other episodes, including ones on vaping, meat-eating and the environment, and the British Constitution. You can find them all on BBC Sounds.
The White House, Washington, October 9th, 2019.
8 days ago, the President of the United States sent the President of Turkey, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, a letter.
Dear Mr. President, let's work out a good deal. You don't want to be responsible for slaughtering thousands of people, and I don't want to be responsible for destroying the Turkish economy. And I will.
President Trump was writing in the aftermath of Turkish forces and Turkish-backed militias moving in to fill the vacuum created by his sudden withdrawal of US troops from the Turkish-Syrian border. He wanted Mr. Erdogan to take it easy.
Don't be a tough guy. Don't be a fool. I will call you later. Sincerely, Donald J. Trump.
We had to call the White House to make sure this wasn't a hoax. It's just so unusual.
If American journalists were astonished, the Turks seemed unimpressed. Turkish presidential sources told the BBC President Erdogan received the letter, thoroughly rejected it, and put it in the bin. So this week, I want to know how the US withdrawal came about, how the Americans came to abandon the Kurdish-led fighters known as the Syrian Democratic Force, who had been the West's main allies in the battle against the so-called Islamic State in Syria, and what it means for the region and the rest of the world. Don't be a fool. Step inside the briefing room to find out. First up, I want to take you back to a phone call between Mr. Trump and Mr. Erdogan the Sunday before last. Eric Schmidt, senior writer at the New York Times covering terrorism and security, joined me in the briefing room to tell me what happened and why.
There was a lot, obviously, on President Erdogan's mind, as he had been warning for several days about an impending invasion of Turkish forces across the border into northern Syria.
And so what do we think President Trump was expecting to get out of this phone call?
Well, I think all his advisors had basically warned him that the Turks were in a position to come across the border. Turkey and the United States had tried to resolve some of their differences over this matter by setting up a safe zone or buffer zone. It was set up for a couple of purposes. One was President Erdogan has talked about wanting to create an area where he can put several hundred thousand Syrian refugees who've come into Turkey as a result of the Syrian civil war over the last several years, get them out of his country and put them back into Syria. But in addition, to push back the Syrian Kurds on the other side, push them back away from the border. Turkey views the Kurds as a threat, a security threat to them. But the United States, because it is an ally of the Syrian Kurds on the other side, Kurds have been a very important ally in the fight against ISIS, they had been opting for a much more deliberate pace. But Erdogan was even more forceful than ever, saying, no, no, this pace is way too deliberate for me. I'm not getting the results that I want. I'm going to invade.
And how did that then lead to the response that it did from President Trump?
Well, the president, even though he may have been prepared for this, basically said, well, if you're coming across, I guess I need to get my forces that are along the border out of there. There at the time, there were about less than 50 American troops right up along this border. So the first thing that happened was this tripwire force was going to be pulled back, basically giving the green light for the Turks to go in and create their offensive. This, in turn, has kind of set in motion a much broader withdrawal of all 1,000 American forces that have been in northeastern Syria over the last couple of years, and basically providing some modicum of security in this corner of Syria.
Why would 1,000 troops, let alone 50 at the border, why would 1,000 troops make such a difference?
Well, it's interesting. This relatively small number of troops has created leverage. It's basically enough to help the much larger Syrian Kurdish and Arab force on the ground, which is tens of thousands, but they also provide a hedge against other actors from moving into that part of Syria, specifically the Syrian regime and their patrons, the Russians, as well as the Iranians.
Do you think that President Trump intended originally to remove all those American troops?
You know, it's hard to understand what might have been in his thinking all along. The president, of course, last December did just that. He, in a tweet, he ordered all 2,000 at the time American troops to leave Syria immediately. This caused a very much of an outrage on both the left and the right here in the U.S., as well as among allies. And the president's advisors were able to basically talk him down off of that proposal. The thinking is, though, that President Erdogan understands how sensitive President Trump is to the notion of having American troops in what he calls foreign entanglements. He does not distinguish, however, between the relatively narrow and efficient mission, say, in northeastern Syria, with the much larger, somewhat sprawling missions in Iraq and Afghanistan that have taken nearly, obviously, two decades worth of American treasure. So I think what happened here was President Erdogan, basically, as he threatens to invade, put Mr. Trump in a position where he can either push back solidly, which he did not, or he can start withdrawing troops so they don't end up in harm's way in front of this Turkish offensive, but then try and put it into a positive political light for his supporters and saying, look, all I'm doing is drawing down the forces in the Middle East, as I've always promised. I don't think he personally understood the ramifications of how quickly things could unspool, as we've seen just in the last 10 days or so.
So you don't think he expected what happened to happen?
I know his advisors have warned him this would happen, so it's hard to imagine he hadn't been briefed on this, whether he totally internalized it or believed it. This president is famously known for trusting his gut rather than his advisors or what, you know, briefings he gets. So I think the notion that he could withdraw these troops and, oh, by the way, save some money by doing so, in his mind, he would not only save the cost of maintaining this small number of American forces in northeastern Syria, but he would also be relieved, in his mind, of having to continue to support the Syrian Kurds on the ground.
What's been the reaction from the different sectors in America, I mean, the military, political, Congress?
Yesterday was an extraordinary day in Washington where the president faced a very large bipartisan condemnation. Key Republican supporters of the president, such as Senators Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the Senate Majority Leader, were sharply critical of the president for his actions. And so I think the president finds himself at a time when he's already under tremendous pressure from the growing impeachment inquiry, increasingly isolated in a key foreign policy decision. And in the span of 10 days, you have unraveled this agreement, created a looming humanitarian disaster, upended decades of American foreign policy in the Middle East, and handed a victory to some of America's most implacable adversaries in the region.
Eric Schmidt. So what exactly does Turkey want out of all of this? Joining me in the studio is Dr. Amanda Sloat, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, who worked for the State Department under President Obama.
The one thing that President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has been remarkably consistent on is his objectives in Syria. Over the last number of years, he has wanted one main thing, which is to create a buffer zone along the border between Turkey and Syria. And this would serve two primary objectives. One would be to push the Syrian Kurdish YPG fighters off his border. And the second is to create a safe space for the Syrian refugees that have been flooding Turkey.
Does he want to move the refugees that are currently in Turkey to that zone?
He does. Turkey is currently flooded with up to 4 million refugees, and they are starting to put a bit of strain on Turkey's domestic politics as well as their social services. So in Erdogan's vision, he has always wanted to have a space to put them back to. And in his grander vision of this, he pictures the building of cities and larger constructions that he could move them into.
Presumably the previous administration had close relationships with Kurdish fighters, one imagines, because they wanted to get rid of ISIS and these were the people prepared to do the fighting and the dying for them. Was it conceived of then as being a long-term relationship?
So I was serving in the Obama administration at the time when these discussions were happening. As you'll recall, President Obama was not interested in getting involved in the Syrian civil war. However, when ISIS emerged, the Islamic State was seen very much as a threat to the United States, to Europe, and to our regional allies. And so it was at that point that President Obama decided action needed to be taken. Once it became clear that ISIS was going to be a much broader threat, the United States wanted to find ground forces that it could partner with, and one of the obvious choices was the YPG. Turkey, not surprisingly, objected to the United States working with the YPG because of the links with the PKK.
The PKK, which is this Kurdish radical party, which operates inside Turkey as a terrorist organization, right?
The PKK has long been struggling for Kurdish rights in Turkey. This has been a long-running threat in Turkey, and it's why Erdogan and many Turks have seen the PKK as a bigger threat even than the Islamic State. If you look at the conflict on both sides, there's been over 40,000 people that have been killed in Turkey as a result of the violence between the PKK and the Turkish government. So this is something that a lot of Turks see as a threat to them. From the American perspective, the British perspective, the European perspective, the PKK was designated as a terrorist organization. The YPG was not designated as a terrorist organization, and so they were seen as somewhat distinct groups, and there was a legal difference between the two of them, which is what enabled the Obama administration to go forward in working with the YPG.
So what you're describing is a classic fudge. On the one hand, the West was saying, yes, we quite understand you've got this problem with the PKK and they are terroristic. And on the other hand, the West was saying, but these other people, the YPG, who are actually closely related, other people we need to give military support to and political support to in the battle against ISIS. Now, at some point or other, it must have occurred to somebody that these things were going to come into sharp collision.
The United States policy had been that our cooperation with the Syrian Kurds was, as one State Department official put it, temporary and transactional and tactical. We were cooperating with them with the limited objective of defeating the Islamic State. We were not cooperating with them to support their desire to create this autonomous region, even though that is exactly what's happened and the consequence that we now have to deal with.
That must fall under the category of obvious future fictions.
The decision was made at the time that the priority of defeating the Islamic State was the greatest. And so it was a bit of a case of meeting short-term objectives and kicking the ball down the road on some of the medium and longer-term consequences.
If one consequence of this is an increase in Russian power, and to a certain extent Iranian power, in Syria, how far will that bother Turkey?
It's always been very interesting to look at the Turkish-Russian dynamic because on one hand, they are on opposite sides of the conflict in Syria. Erdogan has been very clear from the beginning that he wanted to see Assad gone. It's why he was focused earlier in this conflict on defeating Assad rather than on defeating the Islamic State. Russia, on the other hand, has come in and has militarily propped up the Assad regime. So you've got a long-standing, complicated relationship between Turkey and Russia. There's a lot of energy dependence, there's a lot of economic dependence, and Turkey also needs Russian support for the broader endgame with the conflict in Syria. At the same time, you are now going to have Russian-backed regime forces up on the Turkish border, which at least from Turkey's perspective is seen as preferable to the YPG forces. And there still are unresolved questions about what the broader security and governance arrangements are going to be to end this conflict overall in Syria.
Amanda Sloat. So that's Turkey. What about Syria itself? Earlier, I was joined down the line from Washington by Charles Lister, senior fellow at the Middle East Institute and author of The Syrian Jihad. I asked him who he saw as the winners and losers from the US withdrawal and the Turkish offensive.
Well, I mean, the biggest loser here is the Kurds and the broader umbrella that they'd managed to put together with American and international support under the Syrian Democratic Forces. I mean, they have sacrificed a huge amount alongside the US and the counter-ISIS coalition. Since 2014, they've lost over 11,000 soldiers or fighters in securing the territorial defeat of ISIS. We had propped them up, we had secured them, we had trained and equipped them to fight that battle. And then at this sort of crux moment, we dramatically and unexpectedly pulled out due to the president's sort of unexpected decision. And so they've lost everything. In a matter of 4 days, they went from hurriedly putting up a defense against the Turkish military to effectively surrendering almost everything to the Syrian government with Russian facilitation. They had built a project that a Kurdish community across the region had never really actually dreamt would come true in terms of being truly semi-autonomous, and they were engaged in this kind of democratic experiment. But at the snap of a button, it's gone.
What had the Kurds hoped to achieve if this hadn't happened? What were they looking to do in the longer term?
Well, idealistically, they were hoping, I think, still to establish a sort of semi-autonomous statelet, either within Syria or semi-outside of a kind of reformed Syrian border. More realistically speaking, what they were hoping to achieve was a more consolidated semi-autonomous state with American protection that would then take a seat at a big negotiating table when all of the international community came together to discuss Syria's future. And at that seat of the table, of course, the Kurds would have held roughly a third of the entire country, over 70% of its oil resources, a good deal of its agriculture.
How far does this help Russia meet an objective in the region? And what do you take that objective to be?
Well, first off, in the region, I think Russia has made a name for itself as being an opportunistic actor, stepping into vacuums that the US has either provided or left behind. If we're looking at Syria specifically, this, I think, is the greatest or the biggest strategic victory for the Russians that they have won since intervening in Syria 4 years ago. I mean, they could never really have dreamt that it would have been so easy. The Syrian regime, Iran, its militias, the Russian military, none of them fired a single bullet. And yet, at the click of a button, the US left and its proxies, its very powerful proxies, the Syrian Democratic Forces, literally surrendered in a matter of 4 days.
This, therefore, is a very substantial success for President Assad, I imagine you'd say. But how easy is it for him to consolidate Syrian government control in the areas that have been conceded?
That's probably the most important question, and the most important context here is that strategically, this all represents a massive victory for the regime and its international backers. The reality here still is that the Syrian regime still suffers from a crippling manpower shortage. It just simply doesn't have the men in its armed forces or its paramilitary and militia structures to continue to both take territory back from its enemies and hold it. And so this sudden capture or acquisition of a third of the country is, yes, a strategic victory, but it will necessitate a huge drain on regime military resources to continue to hold this territory. And let's not forget, there will be a continued ISIS insurgency. There's probably going to be a new form of armed resistance from Arab tribes who are resisting the deal that really the Kurds have made with the regime on their behalf. There's going to be definitely complications between the Turkish military and the Syrian regime military. And all of that really is going to strain probably uncontrollably, the Syrian regime's resources. And that's why, if you zoom up on a 40,000-foot level, the country as a whole is going to be mired by deep, deep, deep instability for a very long time to come. And this only makes that worse.
Now, one of the things that we've seen is the release or the escape of some ISIS prisoners. But thinking about it more in the context of so-called Islamic State capacity to regenerate its activity, does this provide it with a fillip, or is the organization largely destroyed?
Well, the organization lost all of its territory, but then ISIS has existed and in fact thrived for much longer without territory than with it. So the territorial defeat of the ISIS caliphate, as it's often described, was certainly not the defeat of ISIS. They have continued to launch attacks on a daily basis ever since that territorial defeat, both in Syria and in Iraq. But undoubtedly, this offers the gift of an ISIS rebirth. Their biggest and most powerful and most potentially sustainable enemy, the Syrian Democratic Forces alongside the international coalition, have crumbled in front of their eyes. And if there's anything we know about ISIS is they thrive on chaos. And they will undoubtedly benefit from instability and ethnic and sectarian divisions and lots of competing state powers trying to grab and eat up various bits of territory in this northeastern region of the country.
Charles Lister. Finally, looking ahead, what does all this mean for US influence in the Middle East, for other regional players, and indeed for all of us? Joining me from Washington are Seth Frantzman, author of After ISIS, America, Iran and the Struggle for the Middle East, and Lida Khatib, head of the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House. Seth Frantzman, what's been the impact of President Trump's threat to sanction Turkey?
Well, I think it's only encouraged Turkey to dig in its heels a bit. I don't think there's much evidence that Turkey's going to change. It says basically it's going to continue this operation. From what I understand of Turkey's rhetoric, it's kind of put itself in this corner that it can't go back, and it's promised its people and also the Syrian Arab rebels that it's backing that it will carve out what it calls this kind of safe zone or peace corridor. I guess the question mark is how big that will be. But I think the American sanctions might take effect, but Turkey will just turn to Russia or Iran or other countries that it's already trading with.
Lena, can we look at what the US withdrawal means for the fight against terror in the region? We have already heard that the so-called Islamic State might have been strengthened, but what about other groupings?
Well, other groupings like Hay'at Tahrir al-Sham, which is the offshoot of the group used to be known as Nusra, which used to be affiliated with Al-Qaeda, will actually welcome this new development. They are rivals when it comes to ISIS, but at the same time, they also regard the Syrian Democratic Forces as rivals. And so anything that weakens the Syrian Democratic Forces for them means an opportunity to expand their presence in Syria, and therefore, I expect that they will see what's happening now as an opportunity to consolidate their nascent government. They're trying to say we are not just a military group, we are also an administration. And they will try to expand also their military kind of presence in the area. However, because of their rivalry with ISIS, and because ISIS is also likely to gain from having the Syrian Democratic Forces weakened, because the Syrian Democratic Forces, or the SDF, had been the main group fighting ISIS in northeast Syria, this means that an ISIS resurgence will cause rivalry between it and HTS. So we're just entering an even more complicated phase in this conflict.
Now, where is Iran in all this, Seth?
Actually, it's interesting. Iran has been relatively coy and a bit silent. I think Iran understands that if it starts to brag about how great this is, it might cause some members of the administration to say, well, you see Donald Trump, now what's happening is the Iranians are trying to come in. So I think Iran would like to wait and see, because Iran's main goal would eventually be, obviously, not just to support the Syrian regime, but I think also to gain some sort of presence along the Iraqi border. I think Iran's long-term strategy will hope to have a bit of influence in these areas that America is leaving, because when there's that vacuum, obviously someone has to fill it, and the Syrian regime doesn't have a lot of forces. So I think that's where Iran is looking.
Is that how you see it, Lena?
Well, I was in Turkey last month speaking to some of the military leaders of Syrian Arab rebels who did not like the Syrian Democratic Forces. These were the groups operating in the northeast. And what they told me was that for them, they preferred the Syrian Democratic Forces to Iran, even though they really hate the Syrian Democratic Forces. But for them, the SDF is the lesser evil. So now with the SDF gone, the Iranian-backed forces in the northeast are likely to try to expand their presence in the area. And that means potential clashes with these Syrian Arab groups that are now entering basically with Turkish forces into the northeast, or at least expanding their presence in that area.
What are the implications for Iraq of what's been happening?
Well, we have to remember how huge this area is along the border, right? The area that the U.S. is abandoning is, I think, almost the size of the Kingdom of Jordan or the size of a large U.S. State like West Virginia or something. And this is the same area, by the way, that, of course, ISIS was able to pour across in June of 2014, which caused this whole war in the first place, partly. And so I think all across Iraq, there's a lot of concern that Iraq is just recovering from this war. And now you have all this instability being unleashed without a moment's notice, without the Americans even bothering to really consult them.
I'd like you both to consider the question of what all this says about America's presence in the area. Lena.
I think what we are witnessing right now is the snowball that keeps growing that actually started under former President Obama. Back then, we saw the US slowly retreating from the Middle East. And when Trump came to power, he just continued this process. And I expect that with the new American president next year, whether it is President Trump or someone else, we are not going to see as much involvement for the US in the Middle East as we used to.
Linda Khatib, are you saying that essentially that President Trump has just done quickly what other presidents would have done more slowly?
Well, in a way, yes. I mean, he's done it rather flamboyantly. Many people take issue with his choice of language, such as in his recent letter to President Erdogan. I think this is a path for U.S. foreign policy towards the Middle East that is becoming clearer and clearer every day, that is based on looking inwards rather than outwards when it comes to the Middle East. We are not going to see as much involvement anymore. I think the era of the U.S. being a game changer in the region is over.
Seth, that era was practically, at some points, what helped guarantee the existence of Israel.
Well, to some extent, I think Israel's always understood that in the worst case scenario, it will be alone. Israel, of course, has very close relations with the U.S. in terms of arms and things like that, and it goes both ways. Israeli technology equips American tanks and things. But I think Israel's very, very concerned. I mean, America has walked away from a huge piece of real estate, it looks like, in Syria. America may be pushed out of Iraq, not by its own doing, but by Iraq's parliament at some point. And Trump's natural instinct is to say, listen, this is 7,000 miles away. These people in the Middle East are just fighting each other. It's not our problem, which I think, of course, for Israel is like, well, okay, that's interesting. But then, well, if we have to fight a war with Iran or if we have other enemies that we have to struggle against, what's the American role? And I think that Israel is certainly paying very close attention to this. And Israel has to think then, okay, who are our potential allies or friends in the region or even countries that we share interests with?
I was just wondering if you would care to think about what other allies, non-Middle Eastern allies of the United States, would make of how this has been handled.
When it comes to anyone who's an ally of the United States, I think it's becoming clear that foreign policy is no longer the main concern for the U.S. administration. It's more national issues. However, issues like ISIS are actually global in impact, even if right now this potential resurgence is taking place in Syria. This does not mean that the rest of the world is not going to be affected. And here I'm mainly talking about Europe. I think Europe is very concerned about this new path taken in the United States. However, Europe is not exactly able to force Washington's hand in any way or set its own alternative foreign policy path either. So really, Europe is stuck between a rock and a hard place. They can't really influence things in Washington, they can't influence things in the Middle East, and yet they will be the first to be affected by, say, a resurgence of ISIS.
Lena Khatib there with Seth Frantzman. Often at this point in the programme, I offer listeners a summary, and today it's this. We seem increasingly to live in a world where the old assumptions about alliances and diplomacy no longer apply. And we should also remember that what happens in Syria very rarely stays in Syria. My thanks to Eric Schmidt, Dr. Amanda Sloat, Charles Lister, Seth Frantzman, and Lina Khatib. And we'll be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirsty Knight, Ellis Palmer, Tom Wright, and Serena Tarling. And if you'd like to listen to more episodes, you can catch up by going to BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parris. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.